privilege of having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. I admonish to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and all of the court. Be seated, please. Case number 12-5274, Thomas Davis et al. Appellant, pension benefit guarantee program, Mr. Shelley, the appellant, is Honorable for the appellant.
Shelley.
Good morning, and may it please the court, I'm Anthony Shelley, here for the appellants. 30 years ago, in one of this court's first decisions involving the PBGC, Reddick versus the PBGC, 744 F. 2nd 133, the court, in holding in favor of the participants, said this, at page 155, remedial statutes are to be liberally construed to effectuate their purposes. There can be no doubt that ERISA, and in particular its provision for termination insurance under Title IV, is a remedial statute. One of Congress's central purposes in enacting this complex legislation was to prevent the great personal tragedy suffered by employees whose vested benefits are not paid when pension plans are terminated. The PBGC itself has successfully argued in other cases that coverage under ERISA should be liberally construed to provide the maximum degree of protection to working men and women, while exemptions should be confined to their narrow purpose. The PBGC lost sight of these guiding principles in this case, construing ERISA, its regulations, and every exemption and the plan terms against the plan participants. Even where the district court noted there were two reasonable potential answers on questions, the PBGC didn't hold in favor of the participants. The district court, though, was no check on that because the district judge gave unwarranted deference to the PBGC on every issue. We asked this court to correct those errors and to reverse or vacate the lower court decision. The issues in this case fall into two categories. There are deference issues, and there are the ultimate merits of the nine claims that are in dispute. I'd like to first focus a bit on the deference question. The issue in this case is a unique one in the sense that it involves the question of how much deference the PBGC should get when it acts as a statutory trustee and fiduciary rather than as a government entity. And the question arises in three different settings.
Is it unique? Is it a case that they always end up being the trustee?
They do. According to the PBGC, in all terminated large plan cases at least, they have been the trustee since ERISA was founded. But the statute in no manner requires that the PBGC be as such. While that's a practical point, that they have been the trustee, the court needs to look at the statutory language and the delegation of authority in the statute to see whether Congress intended the agency to have lawmaking power in this particular situation, particularly under the Chevron analysis. In this particular situation, the delegation is to the plan administrator, not to the PBGC. We're dealing with Section 1344 of 29 U.S.C., which is the allocation of assets in a plan. To just give it some context, ERISA in Title IV talks about the PBGC as the corporation. It uses the word the corporation, and it's given many governmental tasks, such as terminating a plan and paying insurance for benefits. But separately, a plan administrator, upon the PBGC's termination of the plan, is supposed to dissolve the plan and liquidate it and pay its assets out. That delegation of authority is to the plan administrator, not to the PBGC. And the PBGC takes on that role, but it's not a governmental role. And the key is that the language of the delegation, the Supreme Court said in the Gonzalez case, the key is the language of the delegation itself.
Why isn't this issue on Chevron deference foreclosed by the earlier panel decision in this case?
Because it's not the law of the case.
Why is it?
Because under the Shirley case, the S-H-E-R-L-E-Y, the Shirley case, the court made, this is just a year or two ago, the court made clear that an earlier D.C. Circuit ruling on a preliminary injunction is not binding unless there was full briefing on it in the earlier case and full elucidation of the issues. There was no full briefing on the issues.
You didn't raise the issue of Chevron deference in the case at all on briefing, earlier briefing?
Well, we did raise it, but not the particular angles of Chevron deference that we're raising here. So, for instance, we didn't raise the only issue there. First of all, the only briefing that occurred there, we filed a motion for a stay, a 20-page motion of a stay pending recoupment, of stay of recoupment pending appeal. The PBGC moved for disposition of the appeal in its entirety. There was no briefing. There were just two motions, essentially. And the court, two judges on this panel, actually, granted our stay. But asked us to put blue covers and red covers on these motion papers, which we did, which were then given to another panel. That panel dissolved the stay and did reach Chevron deference in one paragraph of its decision. But it wasn't fully briefed.
They say that the pilot's position is, while acknowledging that PBGC generally receives Chevron deference, that deference should not apply, the pilots say, when the PBGC is acting as trustee rather than guarantor. So
correct.
You did make that argument.
We made that argument, but we didn't assert, for instance, we had many things to address in that brief. And law of the case doesn't only applies to issues decided. And the court didn't look at the question of whether the delegation of authority allowed for Chevron deference. That was an angle we didn't raise in that particular four pages of the brief. We didn't have the usual 14,000 words in that brief or a 7,000 reply brief. These were two motion papers on which the court decided it. And the Shirley case makes plain that if that's the case and there hasn't been full briefing, the ruling is not binding. There's also been the intervening Jicarilla decision, which we rely heavily on in our brief, noting that when the government takes on a fiduciary role, trust law can apply as opposed to the usual rules that and the usual rules and benefits of the doubt that the government might otherwise get. That came up since that decision. In addition, there's the First Circuit's case that was just issued last month that now addresses how much deference the PBGC is to be given. And that's even in a governmental setting, not in a plan administrator type of setting. And the First Circuit went our way. The First Circuit said there's no Chevron deference.
Well, that was a different factual situation. I mean, the PGBC responded as to why that case was totally distinguishable from what we have here.
But it's not a distinction with a difference. What they say is that...
Well, it was interpreting a different statute. It's administered by a different agency. So the court said, you know, Skidmore deference is what you'll get.
Well, what the court said was that...
I don't want to belabor the point, yeah, though, because your time is limited. But at any rate...
Well, what the court said was that the appeals board issues informal adjudications and therefore isn't entitled to deference I think it was terms of ERISA that it was interpreting. And what the PBGC says in response to that case is that, well, its decisions are binding on the parties here. We made the point that the First Circuit noted the website of the PBGC, which says that the decisions are not binding on any other parties. If they're not binding on any other parties, the appeals board's decision cannot have the effect of a rule of law. And that's the key to Chevron deference, is that the decision has to have the effect of a rule of law. But it also, the First Circuit, the first decision Chief Judge Garland that you mentioned, only, if it addressed anything, it only addressed Chevron deference. It didn't address our deference, and it certainly didn't address the interpretation of plan terms, which is relevant to several of the claims.
In Boivin, didn't we decide the our question in the context of Jefferson versus Shalala, which is the identical test? Said we defer to the agency's interpretation of its own regulations, including where it's a trustee. Why doesn't Boivin resolve that question?
Well, I think in Boivin, what the court was doing was accepting a concession of counsel in that case. I don't think the issue was exhaustion. It wasn't deference. It was exhaustion. And the court said we need to have exhaustion because we'll never know how much to defer to the PBGC unless we have their answer in the particular case. And as a result, I don't think it was a full elucidation of the concepts of Chevron or our deference in that context. It needed to touch on it, and it accepted a concession of counsel in that case. There are many more parties in this case than were in that case, and therefore we don't think that that should govern in this case where the central issue is deference. The central issue is one of the central issues is deference. But the third type of deference, too, is plan interpretation deference, and that wasn't addressed in Boivin, and that also wasn't addressed in the earlier decision on the preliminary injunction in this case. It's important to note that the PBGC is asking for deference on plan interpretation when, in fact, it is not even an expert on this particular plan. This was drafted by U.S. Airways, and our point is that the decision should be given the arbitrary and capricious standard, but diluted for a conflict of interest in a particular case. We've noted that many courts have applied the arbitrary and capricious test, whether an APA standard or a Firestone standard for planned term interpretation, but it's diluted when there's a conflict of interest, and there are several indications of a conflict of interest in this case. For instance, the PBGC, when it was interpreting the plan terms, particularly on Claim 8, attempted to maneuver the record on Claim 8, and we had attempted to present evidence of U.S. Airways' intent. The PBGC Appeals Board wouldn't accept it, and then we attempted to present to the court. The court wouldn't accept it at first. We presented it in another appeal to the PBGC, and the PBGC attempted to hurry the decision along in the district court in order to deny the court the benefit of the evidence that was before it in the appeal. It suggests a decision that the PBGC wanted to reach a result and didn't want to fully elucidate the issues before the court. I'd like to turn for a moment to some of the claims in the case.
Just on one standing issue on Claim 8, on the question of the 50% retirement income supplement for participants who become totally and permanently disabled, is there anybody who fits in that category that you've identified?
Just the question once more, Chief Justice.
Yeah, on Claim 8, the section about the 50% retirement income supplement, that's for those participants who became totally and permanently disabled. Those are people who are on the Allegheny Airlines Systems Plan.
Yeah.
Are there any individuals who fall in that category who've been identified?
I think that one individual we identified in our brief, Mr. Mast, I don't think he falls into that category. He falls into other categories with respect to Claim 8. We've identified 406 people overall, but in the 10 days we had to file that brief, I can't say that we found any particular individual who fit every category of that. But the PBGC never challenged that there were folks. I understand.
So could you file a supplemental response on that question? Unless you're telling us now that you would not be able to find out the answer to that question, whether there was any pilot or beneficiary who would qualify were you to prevail for that 50%.
Yeah, we would be happy to file a supplemental brief. That the issue, there are 406 pilots.
But I want to be clear, in your response, you note that it is sometimes difficult for you to determine whether someone would actually get more because the calculations are something that the PBGC does, and those records are not available to you.
That's absolutely
given
correct.
That, do you still think you would be able to identify such a pilot or beneficiary?
From the records we have, we think it's potentially, I can't say for sure, it's potentially possible. We would let the court know if we could or we couldn't. But you're exactly right. The issue is that the PBGC holds the keys to all the records on the claims. And the PBGC, in its supplemental brief on standing, in particular, noted that it didn't note anything. It didn't present any facts to the court, and it's a fiduciary in this particular situation. We find it difficult often to navigate through the
No, I understand, yeah. And you know the PGBC dealt with the claim on the merits, and that sort of implies that there was somebody who was going to benefit, but in any event, we need to know.
Yes, and then it washed its hands of trying to show that there was any individual.
So I'll ask the Chief Judge if we could get a...
And how long do we have in mind to be able to produce this?
10 days.
Okay.
On that particular issue under Claim 8.
Yeah, we're looking for some actual persons to be identified. We're not really looking for argument. We're just looking for...
Particularly the 50% supplement.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes, sir. I'd like to just, in the minute I have left, point particularly Claims 1 and 2. On Claims 1 and 2, the 5-year look-back provision was held against the participants in the plan. And on that, but it's really a wooden application of the 5-year look-back. The 5-year look-back was designed to avoid situations where the the U.S. Airways, the plan, would load up the benefits just before termination, before it was imminent, and then attempt to saddle the PBGC with those types of with those benefits. We know for sure that that didn't happen on Claim 1. We know that's the ERIP, the Early Retirement Income Plan benefit. We know for sure it didn't happen, particularly on Claim 2, where the actor in the case is Congress. Congress is the one who raised the Section 415B limit that's at issue in Claim Number 2. Nonetheless, these exemptions, which the Reddick case that I read at the beginning indicates should be narrowly construed, is being broadly construed, not even for its purpose, but instead to sort of in a gotcha way on Claim 1 to come up with 30 more days to push the benefit outside the period.
Congress often adopts a rule that the aim of a particular problem adopts a rule which is actually broader than the problem for the very good reason that you limited the rule to the area where the problem actually existed to get entangled with all kinds of complicated factual disputes. So,
well, the,
objectively, the literal application of the rule.
At the same time, even on the merits, this on Claim 1, for instance, the in March of 1998, individuals were making irrevocable elections pursuant to the plan provision. They may not have been receiving the benefits then, but they had to order their affairs and make irrevocable elections. Still, the PBGC says that didn't go into effect until April 1st. If people are actually doing something pursuant to the provision, how can it not be in effect? So I think whether the exemption is liberally or narrowly construed, it doesn't fit that particular claim. So, and I'd like to reserve.
Can I ask you about both parts of Claim 11? First, if you look at the text involved in the first claim, page 656 of the Joint Appendix, can you take us through exactly what language it is that you're focused on, and how you read it?
On Claim 11?
Right.
So the claim involves the manner in which the PBGC construed the standard disability retirement provision in the plan section.
Are we talking about the first full paragraph on page 656?
The yearly amount of basic retirement income, paragraph? Yes,
your brief sort of raises this issue, but it's not focused at all on the text.
On the text of the plan. On the text of the plan being that you're entitled to the minimum benefit if it's greater than the benefit that would otherwise be produced.
Slow down. You're making an argument with respect to the application of the A minus B formula. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And that is introduced by this first separate paragraph on page 656. Mm-hmm. And what I want to know is exactly how you read that paragraph.
Your Honor, if I could maybe read it while Mr. Armbruster is up. I don't have an answer yet for you because I'm trying to push through it.
It is fairly central to one of your claims.
Read the first three lines.
Yeah. So the amount of A.
I don't care about the A minus B formula. It's what triggers the A minus B formula.
So the amount of disability benefit, the triggering, the yearly part.
Yeah.
At the top. So the yearly amount of basic retirement income payable under the plan to a participant who begins receiving disability benefits under the additional benefit programs on or after December 1, 1974, and it was determined to be totally and permanently disabled shall not be less than A minus B.
Right. All right.
So what does that mean to you?
Well, our position is that if B is smaller, you get A.
Yeah, I understand that. But what is it triggers the application of the A minus B?
In other words, the line you read, the third line, has the word and in it. And
oh, I
so
see.
As I understand the PBGC, it takes the position that, you know, the trigger has two parts.
You have to be totally and permanently disabled.
Well, you have to be determined to be totally and permanently disabled.
Exactly. And our position is that there are various ways to be determined. You don't have to be determined at the time of retirement, for instance. There were various ways to determine that you were totally and permanently disabled, whether through an SSA award, whether through a medical examiner, or whether through the retirement board. And it could be retroactive.
So you're saying that under the additional benefit programs, there could be disability determinations during retirement.
Yes.
Under those programs.
Yes. And they could be retroactive because the SSA awards initially used to take a long time, for instance. But someone could be in a situation of being retired and be in the process of getting a disability award, and you can go back and it will be effective by a certain date. That, in fact, is often the case with SSA awards. They're retroactive to a certain date, and our understanding is that U.S. Airways would award those benefits in the event the determination was made, whenever, either before or after, because they're determined to be disabled. It's not a temporal limitation.
I mean, one of the problems is your brief and also the government's brief doesn't give us record citations for these assertions about what was happening. And I'm not doubting what was happening, but sort of no way for us to tell who's right, as it were.
Yeah. Well, the lower court briefs were much lengthier.
I know, but we're talking what you gave us.
Correct. If the point is that you need indication that U.S. Airways or that the plan accepts a later disability determination and makes it effective even prior at the time of retirement, if you're looking for it, that's the type of record site you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and I'll raise this with the PGBC as well. They make the assertion they're just continuing what U.S. Airways did. And you say, no. If you look at the history and all of this, you'll see this is just a timing requirement.
Yeah.
It wasn't this two-pronged eligibility trigger.
Well, it's a matter of practice, even if it weren't in the record, and I want to check to see if it isn't particularly in the record, the reality is the PBGC had an obligation as the fiduciary at the appeals board to figure out exactly what the practice was. Our assertion was that this was the U.S. Airways practice, and there's not any indication from the PBGC that any kind of investigation was done to determine what that was. And really, the fiduciary owes the obligation to the participants to determine the benefits for the participants.
I want to be sure I understand all parts of the argument about this sentence. The first part of the sentence, do you agree that disability benefits had already been paid?
No, because in fact it sets up situations where someone might want to retire at the time of disability and would be forced on, might be eligible for retirement.
So how do we do it with the words who begins receiving? What is that? How do you get from that to somebody who's not already receiving?
That is a timing requirement. So that's someone who, the additional benefits program, someone who begins receiving the retirement benefit. This is a timing issue if they didn't want it to apply to folks who qualified prior to 1974 for the additional benefits program. Not disability insurance, but for the additional benefits program. So, in other words, this was a new plan provision to take effect in 1974 and thereafter.
So you mean by disability benefits, therefore, being eligible for disability, not actually receiving benefits.
Not disability benefits. Could be receiving...
disability benefits.
That seems clear. Yeah.
But it's under the additional benefits programs.
Yes.
Which is part of this plan, as opposed to the disability plan. So...
It's still got to be disability benefits.
But our point... I don't think that that's the way the program had traditionally been employed, and it's one again, I think, where the disability benefits it's really tied to the award of disability thereafter, and we read it as eligibility.
I see. Okay.
On the second part of Plan 11, is there place in the pension plan that requires the pension plan administrator
follow the procedures set forth in the disability plan?
I don't believe so. There is not. In fact, there were different ways to determine disability. One of them was SSA. It was the SSA award. One was to send the individual to a medical examiner, and the third was the retirement board. And in fact, the first decision of the disability plan wasn't even binding on anyone.
So the argument here is not the language in the pension plan controls this, but a kind of common law of practice. Is that correct?
Correct.
And I take that common law, as so often the common law, varied over time, right? I mean, you know in one of your papers the shift of jurisdiction of the U.S. Airways Retirement Board, right?
And it doesn't exist anymore. It
doesn't exist at all.
And so the fiduciary had an obligation to create the same type of avenue. This benefit is forfeited. It's cut off if the fiduciary doesn't create an avenue for it to be secured in the manner it would have been secured prior to the time the plan was terminated.
And I guess we'll have to ask the corporation, but it's undisputed that these devices of appeal were available.
I believe so. Our position is that that is undisputed. It's just that the PBGC says we don't have to run the plan. We don't have to run the plan as an ongoing operation after this time. And the remedy that existed prior to termination is suddenly thrown out the door because the PBGC doesn't want to run a shop of deciding disability claims.
Are you asking the PBGC to create an equivalent of the U.S. Airways?
We're asking them just to accept the option that an individual could get a disability benefit award via a medical examiner's report.
So the medical examiner is the only...
Well, you could also get it through an SSA. The person could go to the SSA, go through that whole process, and get it retroactively defined. But that was rejected in 1980 as the only way. You don't have to just do it that way. You can do it in these other ways. And these individuals, to start up an SSA at their advanced stage at this point, an SSA situation, rather than go to a medical examiner like U.S. Airways would have accepted, is not what would have occurred prior to termination.
So your solution for the corporation is that it simply adopt a rule that includes a reference to a medical examiner?
Not a rule, that it just simply continue the practice and policy of the plan prior to the time of termination, not a rulemaking or anything like that, but it has to, if it wants to be the trustee.
With respect to its administration of this plan.
Yes, and if it wants to be the trustee of the plan, it has to act like the trustee of the plan and provide the participants with the ability to obtain the benefits that the plan promised them in the first place.
I have one question. You were saying that this is a claim under the additional benefits program. In your reply brief, you say that the language defining the retirement benefit is what the participant was, quote, entitled to receive under the additional benefits program. And how do you respond to the corporation's position, as I understand it, that you're mixing those two plans in terms of what the claim is under?
Well, the one...
Mainly the disability plan and then the additional benefits program.
Well, the one works off the other, though. The additional benefits program is part of the retirement plan. And as such, it accepts people who are disabled, totally and permanently disabled, as getting an enhanced benefit. The enhanced benefits that are at issue at Claim 11. It's not tied to the disability plan. It's tied to the additional benefit.
Mm-hmm. Additional benefits, in turn, has a cross-reference to disability.
To being disabled, because disability is, total and permanent disability is part of a traditional...
Yeah, the definition does make a cross-reference, right? As I say, the definition of additional benefit programs is programs of disability benefits, etc.
Correct. You had to qualify. You had to qualify for those benefits. And these medical examiner types of awards allowed you to.
Somewhere there are plans that incorporate these programs, right?
Somewhere there, ask again, Your Honor?
Plans that incorporate these programs that set up the rules governing them.
Such as the pension plan?
No. Yeah. I'm here talking about the pension plan's definition of additional benefit programs. That appears to be a cross-reference to programs.
Correct.
That are not contained in the pension plan, but are contained somewhere else.
And I don't think there's a, and that may be true, but I don't think there's a dispute about the type, the real nub of the dispute here is whether an individual had the ability to qualify for the benefits after retirement, for instance, by getting a certain type of an award. And I don't think the PBGC doesn't dispute that those were allowed. It just doesn't want to do that anymore. It doesn't want to do what was done prior to the time of the termination because it doesn't want to run an ongoing plan. And again, our point on that is that if they're a fiduciary, they have to do those things. So, Your Honor, I think you are correct that there may be cross-references that aren't so clear in the record, but there really isn't dispute about what the actual requirements were in this particular case. It's just a matter of the PBGC not wanting to follow those requirements going forward.
So, we'll hear from the PBGC.
May it please the Court, James R. Brewster for Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. This case is about the benefits that PBGC is paying the pilots under the Title IV insurance program. PBGC may pay only those benefits that the law provides for. And let me note at the beginning here that the pilots argue that PBGC is construing the statute in a narrow way, depriving pilots of their benefits. But as we pointed out in our briefs, and as the pilots never responded to, Priority Category 3 has a kind of zero-sum element to it. If you put more and more benefits into that category, at a certain point, there may not be enough assets left to pay all those benefits, and if that's true, then other participants could actually lose benefits. So PBGC is required to interpret these provisions in a way that looks to the interests of all participants, not just the particular plaintiffs who are before the court. The record shows that the Appeals Board made fair and reasonable decisions on all of the issues here, and based on permissible, and indeed we believe the best interpretations of ERISA, PBGC's own regulations, and the pension plan. And the district court was therefore correct to defer to those interpretations and uphold PBGC's determinations under them. Turning first to Chevron deference, we believe that this court, the prior panel's ruling is law of the case. As Chief Judge Garland noted, the pilots argued strenuously the same argument that they make here, namely that PBGC should not get Chevron deference because it also has this additional role as trustee, and they devoted several pages in their brief to that. It's true that they had fewer pages, but they had a 20-page main brief and another 20-page reply brief, and that trustee argument related to Chevron figured prominently in all of that. The main difference now is that the pilots say, well, we have superseding authority, and they point to this Hikaria case, which is new. However, it's entirely off point. The case had nothing whatsoever to do with deference. The court never even mentioned the word deference there. So we believe that the prior panel's ruling that PBGC gets Chevron deference is law of the case. But
what about their other argument that the question is whether or not you had a lawmaking authority delegated to you in this capacity?
Your Honor,
so they didn't make that argument.
That may be true, Your Honor, but it was a subsidiary point. But in any event, we've addressed that in our supplemental brief about the Sun Capital case. The Supreme Court has made clear that PBGC does get deference. There are three cases that have granted PBGC deference from the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. The LTV case, the Tilley case, and in 2007, the Beck case, which was a unanimous decision. And Beck, incidentally, was 6 years after the Mead case that the pilots rely so heavily on. And Mead has to be understood in its particular, under its particular facts. In that case, The agency was asking for deference for customs classification rulings made in 46 different offices around the country, more, to the rate of more than 10,000 per year. And the Supreme Court said, well, it defies common sense to think that Congress would have intended deference in that kind of a situation. This case is far different. The ruling here was made by PBGC's Appeals Board, which has authority to make final determinations for PBGC. Moreover, it's important to keep in mind that a lot of the lawmaking that PBGC did here was in PBGC's own regulations. The crucial provision that relates to Claim 3, 29 U.S.C. Section 1344A, talks about the benefits under the plan provisions in effect during the 5 years before termination. PBGC's regulation spelled out that that should be interpreted to be based on the lowest benefit payable at any time during the 5 year period. And here it was undisputed that the lowest benefit payable was the benefit payable in April 1998, which was the first year of the 5 year period. And no pilot could receive, or no pilot did receive, benefits during that month. So therefore, the interpretation that the appeals board put on this flows really pretty much directly from the regulation. And clearly, the regulations are created by PBGC in its role as federal agency, not as trustee. So that argument really doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And moreover, as the prior panel held, PBGC does not somehow lose its agency expertise just because it also has this rule of this additional role as trustee. As Chief Judge Garland noted, PBGC has been trustee of virtually every pension plan that's terminated since 1974, some 4,500 plans. So we have a lot of expertise in interpreting plans as well. Turning to deference to PBGC's interpretation of its own regulations, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that an agency's interpretation of its own regulations is controlling unless plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulation. The Supreme Court reiterated that just a couple months ago in the Decker case. And as Chief Judge Garland noted, this court in the Boivin case, which was related to this case, the court also held that PBGC is entitled to deference in interpreting its own regulations. And finally, with respect to still on deference to PBGC's interpretations of the pension plan, this court earlier this year in the United Steel case held that PBGC's application of the terms of a pension plan to the facts of the case should be reviewed under the APA arbitrary and capricious standard. But in a footnote, the court noted that even if the case involved interpretation of the pension plan, which was not the case in United Steel, but if it were, that PBGC might well get deference under the rationale of this court's earlier ruling in the National Fuel case. In National Fuel, this court held that agencies generally get deference for their interpretations of a contract within the area of the agency's expertise, based, first of all, on Chevron principles, and also based on the agency's expertise. This case, we submit, is just like National Fuel. PBGC, as I mentioned, is the trustee of some 4,500 terminated plans. In order to pay benefits under those plans, we have to construe every single one of them. So we have a great deal of experience in interpreting plans.
And your response to the argument of appellants that the corporation is conflicted in the interpretation of the plan is what exactly?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the record shows that PBGC made reasonable determinations.
Well, that's an issue you reach after you've decided how you're going to view the matter. View the matter with suspicion of the corporation, as the appellants urge us, make a different outcome.
Well, if
this goes back to an earlier point that you made, but didn't really develop, and that is the question of whether generosity, quote, to a particular set of pilots in a case under PC3 may in fact have no impact on the operations of the corporation may adversely impact other beneficiaries of the very same plan. Are you arguing that here?
Well, our position is that PBGC, first of all, is trustee of virtually every plan. So if you take the position that, well, we're conflicted, that would mean we'd never get deference. And the Supreme Court in the Glenn case said that it was not taking the position that the vast majority of ERISA cases should be reviewed de novo in the federal courts. Under Glenn, you have to show more than just some general possible conflict because, you know, something could potentially affect the FIS, some actual conflict or something.
Let me try to put it more narrowly. You are not, is it correct, you're not saying here that there's no impact on the corporation's solvency because the structure of PC3 is such that greater benefits for participants X would mean smaller benefits for participants Y? Right.
Well, in this particular case, as the way the facts shook out, there were about $40 million of assets more than the amount needed to pay all the PC3 benefits. So in this case, initially, if some additional benefits were put into PC3, initially it would come out of PBGC's pocket because it would come out of that $40 million. But if the total amount exceeded $40 million, then it would start to come out of the pockets of other participants because they would, at some point, PC3 would no longer be 100% funded.
But we have to get over that $40 million threshold.
Right. But that's,
so we're not there.
Well,
the question is, should you, therefore, your decisions be viewed with suspicion as a result?
Well, I think they should not be viewed with suspicion. And this is a point I was starting to make before, that if you look at the record, the PBGC Appeals Board actually found an error that PBGC had made that the pilots had never even raised and ordered the agency to go and fix that error, which we did. So I don't think that PBGC should be looked at with suspicion. I think, and when you look at the determinations here, I think they, you know, the record shows that the appeals board was eminently fair and reasonable. They're not
by any means outlandish. So you're conflating the appeals board and the corporation? Just want to be clear.
Well, in this case, the determinations were made by the appeals board. Under our regulations, they have the final say on benefit matters.
So,
I just thought if they reversed you, that...
I'm sorry, Matt?
I won't pursue it in any event.
So let me just say, Glenn and Firestone, which are the cases where this rises, these are both private plan administrators, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And those administrators have shareholders. They're for-profit organizations or they're not?
Well, the administrator under a private pension plan can either be an individual appointed by the plan document, or in many cases, the administrator is the corporation, the sponsor of the pension
plan. So the conflict of interest at issue has to do with the corporation's own interest in money, either as a corporation or as or its shareholders, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, I take it PBGC doesn't have any private shareholders.
No, we do not.
And if you make more money or less money, it doesn't go in your pocket or to any member of PBGC itself. It's a government agency.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why aren't you arguing that the distinction is that those cases, no case has ever held that this suspicion test applies to a government agency, only that it applies to private administrators?
Perhaps I should argue that, Your Honor. I think that's a good point. That it's PBGC is fundamentally different from a private corporation. Most of our funds come from PBGC premium payers. So I think that's a point well taken. Turning to the specific claims here, the first claim one involves the early retirement benefits for participants who.
Before you do that, could you respond on the standing question with respect to claim 8 or 3?
Which is the disability piece?
Yes.
Well, I think Your Honor...
Claim 8, part 4. Yeah.
Part 4. I believe Your Honor was correct that the pilots did not specifically identify any individual who satisfied that.
Well, but their question is, Do you know of any such individual? Their argument is that it's really your responsibility to, since you have the control of the records, to answer, at least answer that question, regardless of who has the burden.
We
do
don't
know anyone in that category?
I don't know, Your Honor. We don't agree with that position that we have a duty to find people. It's one thing to say that a PBGC is a fiduciary for certain purposes. And by the way, the statute says that the fiduciary role is limited, is to the extent inconsistent with Title IV. But there's nothing that suggests that PBGC has to somehow, after having gone through this adjudicatory process with our appeals board, to say that we then have to help the disappointed parties sue us and establish their own standing in court, I think is a fairly extraordinary suggestion, and we don't agree with that.
So, are you going to make your records available to the pilots?
We certainly will. The pilots have always had the ability to get additional information from us. PBGC complies with Freedom of Information Act requests. Many parties have availed themselves of that opportunity. And can obtain records from PBGC.
It just seems strange that you go through the whole process if there's no pilot who could possibly get this 50% benefit.
Correct. That would be, well, that's why the standing requirements are, to make sure that there is some
well,
party.
Well, I know. There's no Article 3 requirement, but it's a waste of the agency's time.
Well, the PBGC Appeals Board noted this. I think the board thought that the...
Noted what?
It noted that there was a possibility that some pilots might not necessarily get increased benefits. For example, on Claim 8, the Appeals Board noted that many of the participants were at the Internal Revenue Code's 415B limit,
right,
and therefore it was not necessarily a given that they would get additional benefits, even if they prevailed. But I think the Appeals Board felt that the substantive issues were not that difficult, and it was probably easier to resolve those legal questions than to go scouring the record and try to find this. And of course, the PBGC Appeals Board is not an Article III court and did not have the case or controversy requirement. If I may continue just for a couple minutes, the PC3 benefits relating to the early retirement benefits, the PBGC regulation, as I said, limits the benefit to the lowest benefit payable under the plan provisions at any time. It was clear the benefit was not payable in April 1998.
All right. Since their time is limited, I wonder if I could focus your attention on a couple of things.
Certainly, Your Honor.
All right. Back to Claim 8. One of the arguments that's made by the pilots is that when they were before the appeals board, they tried to get certain information before the board in order to elucidate the meaning of a particular phrase that was relevant to helping them get more benefits. And as I understand the record, and I may be wrong about this, the board had 700 cases before it and said, no, we're just going to rule on the data we have before us. But there were other cases that were proceeding along. And at least in one of those cases, the pilots say they had this additional information as part of the record. And the board refused to delay so that it would have access to this additional record. Then when they got before the district court, the district court took the position, well, it was reviewing only the record that was before the appeals board. And indeed, at one point, the PBGC is quoted as saying, it doesn't matter what affidavits you could put in, they wouldn't make a difference. And the pilots come back and say, well, we do have, or there are affidavits that could have been submitted, and this Everett case also would have information regarding what was intended by the drafters of this language. Do you want to respond and just explain why the appeals board and the corporation would proceed in that manner, given that you have acknowledged that you're serving in this trustee role at this point of time?
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, first of all, in the original appeal, the pilots were represented by counsel, and they submitted a 40-page brief and more than 100 pages of documents, which were presumably the documents they believed were most relevant to their case. These other documents, they for whatever reason, did not produce at that time, so the appeals board ruled on the record in front of it.
But what I'm trying to get at is I understand that they didn't formally present the documents, but they said to the board, we have this additional information available. Then the board rules, and at least in the pilot's opinion, this overlooks the drafter's intent. And everybody proceeds to just ignore that evidence.
Well, the pilots attempted to present it in the case of a pilot named Peterman,
right.
But the board looked at his facts and determined that he would not get any increased benefit even if the PBGC ruled in his favor. But addressing the other point Your Honor made,
yeah.
The board did note that the probative value of any such additional evidence was very minimal at best because one of
But it hadn't seen the evidence. That's what I'm getting at.
Well,
how can you say no affidavit could possibly be relevant?
Well, but I think there was more a proffer of what the evidence would be,
okay.
And so the pilots were essentially saying, "Well, we want to present evidence about what the negotiating parties thought in 1972," and the board said, "Well, you know, evidence about what people thought they intended 40 years ago is much less probative than the plain language of the plan." And I think in that case, it was particularly the language about the unadjusted for dividends. The plan says that you look at the S&P 500 index unadjusted for dividends.
Right. I think those first three, but when you get to the fourth, it's a little trickier.
The fourth being the?
This 50%.
50% supplement for
as to whether or not the triggering mechanism is a two-pronged trigger or not, or it's simply a timing device.
Well, I think if you look at the language, and this is the language that the panel, yeah. your honors were focusing on before, it plainly says the yearly amount of basic retirement income is to a participant who, begins receiving disability benefits under the additional programs and who is determined to be totally and permanently disabled. U.S. Airways always interpreted that to mean that you had to meet both prongs, and PBGC, I think very reasonably, in accordance with the plain language of the plan, also said, look, you have to be meeting both.
Okay. Your brief says that about U.S. Air, but we don't have any cite for that. I mean, how do we know that's what U.S. Air thought?
I know the appeals board discussed that. I don't remember exactly what evidence. The appeals board decisions generally were quite thorough. They may have had evidence about that. But then in any event, I don't think the pilots ever disputed that. They say, and by the way, there was a lot of confusion about the nature of these plans. The disability plan was a separate plan, legally separate entity from the pension plan. The disability plan was part of those additional benefits programs. That was not part of what PBGC was administering. And it's undisputed that before the pension plan terminated, all disability determinations were made under that separate disability plan, which continues to exist today. So
just so I'm clear, according to the pilots, they say that they got this declaration and asked the board to consider this other case because the board's decision had referenced an absence of documentation from U.S. Airways employees who negotiated the minimum benefit provision.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor.
So the board said, we have no evidence. So the pilots say, here's some evidence.
But that was clearly foreseeable. I mean, they were talking about what did the parties intend back in...
I understand clearly foreseeable, but I'm just trying to understand. And the pilots cite this opinion from the Fourth Circuit, Helton, as to why, given the role that the board is playing and that the corporation is playing, since they say, well, we don't have any evidence... And the pilots say, well, we'll offer some evidence to
I don't think a party can reasonably sit back and just say, well, here's our evidence, and if that's not enough, then we'll provide some more. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. You have to come forward with all the evidence that you reasonably think is relevant.
So what should they have done? Filed a motion for reconsideration before the board?
They could have done that, I suppose, but...
And so by doing what they did was tantamount to waiving the right to file a motion for reconsideration? I'm just trying to understand how you get this before the board after the board has ruled initially.
Well, I think what you should do is do it before the board has ruled.
Well, suppose you don't.
Well, I suppose they could have asked for reconsideration.
I mean, the board could have denied it, but I'm just saying, did they have the opportunity to file a motion for reconsideration, and wasn't that the effect of the actions they were taking? That's all I'm trying to understand.
Perhaps. I don't know.
Perhaps what?
Perhaps it was something similar to a motion for reconsideration. But the Peterman case, though, the board decided that even if the pilots prevailed, he was not entitled to any additional benefits, so they just didn't address the merits of his claim at all. But, I mean, it's kind of like a alternative argument. The appeals board is saying, well, you didn't present the evidence, and even if you had, we think it's highly unlikely that it would make any difference anyway, because it's, you know, just evidence about what one person says we intended way back 40 years ago, so...
So, you know, Helton says, and they cite all these Horn books on corporations, that, you know, the corporations are deemed to know whatever is in their files. That's an overstatement, but it's very broad. And the Fourth Circuit says we join that, and they cite all these other circuits that have joined that, too. So if you're conflating the corporation and the board, why isn't the board bound to know what is in its records?
Well, I think under general principles of administrative law, an agency makes determinations based on the record it has at the time. I mean, the process can be never-ending if people can constantly say, well, that's not enough evidence, here's some more. That's not enough, okay, here's some more. It's not a reasonable proposition, I think.
Could you elucidate the corporation's position on the independent medical examiner? I mean, is this an initial problem?
I don't think there's any dispute that before the plan terminated, all disability determinations were made by the administrator of the disability plan.
Right, right. But we're told that has ceased to exist. What's the dispute on that?
I believe it, as far as I know, it does continue to exist, or at least it did up until very recently.
Yeah, we were told the retirement board didn't exist.
I mean, the pilots were saying, Mr. Shelley, I believe, was conflating the two. He was saying that PBGC is refusing to administer the plan, but the plan that we administer is the pension plan. Not, we don't administer the disability plan.
Right. To the extent that the pension plan incorporates by reference a process going on under another plan, why does the corporation not have to continue that?
Well, we did continue to the extent that if there was a determination under that separate plan, we would consider that. And that's exactly what the pension plan says, the provision at page 656.
But then you're saying that if, as we have the appellants arguing, the plan, that the disability plan has ceased operations, then this process has disappeared. So putting together the two statements you're making, you're happy to defer to a process that the appellants say doesn't exist.
I believe that's the first time they've ever asserted it doesn't exist. We stated repeatedly in all of our briefs that the disability plan continues to exist. And as far as I know, it does. So that would be news to me if it doesn't. And certainly it did for many years in any event. The appeals board decision states that unequivocally. So that the pilots could have gone back to the U.S. Airways Disability Plan and gotten a determination.
So just to clarify, so I'm clear, the corporation was not taking the position that if the SSA didn't determine eligibility, then the pilot was not eligible.
Correct. We would accept that as a sufficient to satisfy the second prong of the test if the Social Security Administration determined a person is disabled. And that was consistent. The board carefully looked at the record and said, that's what U.S. Airways did, and we will continue that. And the board did that. But the pilots want to read the first prong out of the test. They say, oh, well, that's just a timing mechanism. But when you look at the language, it clearly does not read as a timing mechanism. It reads as a substantive requirement.
Unless you had all this background information telling you what the drafters intended. I mean, that's the argument, as I understand it.
Right, but I mean, you know, it's very easy many years after the fact to say, well, here's what we intended. But when you look at the language, and also when you look at the way the benefit is structured, this is page 656 of the Joint Appendix, it says the pension benefit depends on the amount of disability benefits that the participant was entitled to receive under the plan. So if there's no determination of disability under the disability plan, how would you even know that? There'd be no way to calculate the pension benefit. So it seems clear that was one of the bases for the appeals board's ruling. It looked at that and said, well, this is how we interpret it, and that's the same way that U.S. Airways interpreted it.
All right. I don't think that there's any time left, is that right? I'll give you another 2 minutes for rebuttal.
A couple points. First, on deference, Mr. Armbruster suggests that because the Supreme Court has previously given deference to the PBGC, that there's basically a rule that the PBGC gets deference. But the Chief Justice in the Mayo Foundation case specifically rejected the idea that deference can be agency-specific. When some special rules of deference were being attempted to be applied to the IRS, and the court said, no, we have a uniform body of administrative law under United States versus Meade and the cases thereafter, and that's how you figure out if there's deference. And as we've argued, they don't fit the Meade test. The customs determinations in Meade are very much like what the PBGC Appeals Board does. In Meade, this is United States versus Meade, the court specifically noted they were not binding on third parties. That's the key. In the document we submitted with our 28J letter, the page from the record, from the website that, in fact, the First Circuit cited, it specifically notes that the Appeals Board's measures are not binding on third parties. On the point that Mr. Armbruster made on claims 1 and 2 that, well, the benefit, you got to go through the 5 years prior to the termination, figure out when the benefit would have been the least, and take that. That's not the right test. The test is to look to see if a plan provision is in effect for 5 years, and it doesn't matter then what the gyrations or changes in benefits were during those 5 years on the bottom line. It matters what matters if the plan provision was in effect. Judge Rogers, your point on Claim 8 is correct, that in fact the pilots did try to present oral testimony to the appeals board the first time around. They refused to accept it. So we were ready to raise the issues that are elucidated later in the affidavits at the time, but the PBGC, the appeals board, denied us the right to a hearing as a result. So it wasn't presented there. It was later presented, and they kind of rigged the proceedings to keep it out of the district court and finish their other appeal after the district court was ruling. And finally, Judge Williams, on Claim 11, the point on that page of 656, while we're getting into this question of whether the disability plan, whether the individual qualified for disability, paragraph A there then says one of the questions is the amount of disability benefits that the participant was entitled to receive, not that they had been receiving or that they'd qualified but were entitled to receive. So our point in our briefing has been that there's an ambiguity in this provision, and the ambiguity shouldn't be read against the pilots. It should be read in their favor. And on the last point of whether the disability plan does still exist, but it was a gatekeeper for disability determinations, and you could go thereafter to the retirement board or a medical examiner to get the disability requirement. The retirement board is gone, and the PBGC won't allow us to use the medical examiner. You have to essentially get the SSA. So that's our point.
Can I just ask, when we were discussing this extra, I'm going to call it parole evidence about the meaning of the plan, that was with respect to Claim 8, you just said. I thought we were earlier also discussing with respect to Claim 11, But I take it there is no argument that there, you have additional outside evidence about Claim 11 with respect to an additional arbiter for these things or anything like that?
Nothing that wasn't presented in the appeal, but we did present in the appeal that this was the practice, that this was the practice, that, that the disability plan itself was the gatekeeper for a disability award, but thereafter you could go to a medical examiner to prove your disability, SSA, and the SSA...
This is not part of the argument about the affidavit that...
Correct. That's, that relates only to Claim 8.
Okay, got it. All right. Thank you. We'll take the matter under submission.